There we go. We can begin the outside video feed, and we are now recording the minutes. Ms. Cowan, this is your line.
Oh, do you want to do your introductions, or do you want me to,
Oh, well, I was going to let you say that we will now start the video feed and begin the meeting.
We are now starting the video feed.
And begin the meeting, great.
At
So,
beginning.
welcome everybody. Yes, and thank you for coming to our meeting today. I know that timing is a little odd and everybody is racing around, and we will be efficient. So, thank you everybody for being here today. The meeting is open to the public. We are recording. We are doing this via video conference. Members of the public can watch, they just cannot. Or they can listen and watch, but they cannot participate. I just did want to say to the members of the public that we do have materials accompanying portions of this meeting, and you will see members looking down, looking at other screens. They are not doing other work. They are simply looking on their devices at other materials that we are using in this meeting. Budget Committee members and others, when you speak, please remember to unmute yourself. Well, let me modify that. Remember to unmute yourself if you have something insightful to say. If you don't, stay muted. That's okay. And then also identify yourself. And when you're not speaking, please keep your mute, be muted so we don't get background noise. All right. With that, Ms. Cowan, you may take the roll.
Judge Rubin,
Here.
Judge Mormon,
Good afternoon.
Justice Fujisaki,
Here. Good afternoon.
Justice Hill,
Here.
Judge Botke,
Here.
Judge Hawk, with us, and Mr. Harrigan.
Here.
We have a quorum. We have 6 out of 7 members.
And Judge Hopp is here as well.
Thank you, Judge Hopp.
All right. Our first order of business is the minutes. It's on pages 3 to 6 of your materials. You've had a chance to review them. Are there any motion? Is there a motion?
Mormon moves to approve.
All right. So there's a motion.
Fujisaki second.
All right. Mormon moves, Fujisaki second. Further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Abstaining. It passes. Thank you very much. With that, Ms. Cowan, have we received any public comment on any of our matters for today?
There is no public comment for the meeting.
Thank you. That concludes the public comment portion. We have before us today's several information items. I know Judge Conklin is in a trial, so we need to kind of take his items right out of the gate, and they're informational. And so, Judge Conklin, you're going to do the interpreter employee incentive grant funding, as well as the court reporters and family law and civil cases transcript rates items. Is that correct?
That's correct. And then the action item I will administer if there's time. I appreciate that. I'm here along with Rebecca Fleming, who is my co-partner in crime on all these issues. Candidly, she's the one that really has the working knowledge of this as a court executive officer, so she's invited, as always, to chime in when she thinks I'm going off track. But with that, the first two items are informational only, the first being the $30 million one-time court interpreter employee incentive grant funding. This is a discussion of the 2021-2022 one-time funding in SB 170. And it's a very particular in the way that it is phrased, for good reason. These funds are dedicated, just as is noted, to court interpreter employee funding, and it's an incentive grant. And it's the way it is framed provides the opportunity for courts to obtain these funds, but at the same time requires courts to commit to being able to employ the individuals who are hired as a result of the funds in an ongoing basis, even though it's a one-time grant. So that obviously creates decision points for the trial courts as they move forward in applying for this grant. The $30 million is broken down into two separate categories. The first is $18 million, again, to pay for the first year of employment and associated costs of new full-time court interpreter staff. The second $12 million is to increase language access in the local courts to the hiring of certified court interpreter employees to provide interpreter services inside the courthouse in support of court users. It has numerous provisions, SB 170, for qualifying courts for this funding, again, as I noted, such as a demonstration of the need for specified languages, and perhaps as significantly, retention of new employees and not supplanting existing funding. Oh, I'm sorry. I was moving on. So this has to do with the information, again, for the courts have to commit to being able to hire those employees on a full-time basis with the funds they receive, even though only one-time funding. It's grant funded, so the courts will apply for these funds. It's anticipated that CFCC will provide information to the TICBAC and will be sending a memo out to all the courts, providing helping them understand the grant process and the funding language. Concerning timing, we're hoping that the application process after it's sent out will commence soon. Once the application for grant awards are evaluated, recommendations will be developed by TICBAC, sent to this committee for their review and approval, and then to the council, hopefully for approval in spring of 2022. Any questions on that informational item?
I was going to say, thank you. Anything from Budget Services on this? All right, seeing none. Any questions for Judge Conklin or anybody in Budget Services? Judge Mormon.
Yes, one question. In terms of the commitment the trial court has to make, and I'm sorry if this is in the material and I missed it, I apologize. What is the commitment the trial court has to make in terms of longevity? Is there some sort of contractual period that the trial court must be able to meet?
They have to be a permanent full-time employee for until forever. I mean, it's not one-time funding. The court has to commit to hiring these permanent employees, take them on and hire them as permanent employees. Obviously, if the court follows standard procedure to terminate, as they would with any employee, but the funding is, the grant is for 1 year, the position is permanent.
Okay. I would just make an observation that the limitations on the trial court budget reserves that we live with, you know, it's a factor in people in trial courts evaluating whether they can do this.
Absolutely. They have to be able to have funding beyond the grant funding to keep these people on for a permanent basis, and that would then turn into their general fund. I agree with you, Judge Mormon.
All right, Judge Hopp.
Is there a limit on when the funding has to be spent? In other words, would the trial court have to spend the money in this fiscal year?
Zlatko, I thought it was 2 year, but am I wrong?
Extended availability, but it is for the equivalency of 1 year's worth of salary. And so they presumably once they've hired, they would need to spend that for that individual over that 1 year.
So you could hire somebody this year, pay part of their salary this year and part next fiscal year, is that right?
That would, given the timing of the allocation, it would seem that would be a necessity, given that we are already through partway through the fiscal year.
Thank you.
Thank you for those questions. Any other questions? This is just an informational item, so there's no motion required. Judge Conklin, thank you. That seems to conclude everyone's questions regarding that item. How about the next item?
Thank you. And again, Rebecca is assisting with this. This
Where is Fleming. There she is.
There Good she afternoon.
Is. How are you?
I hear her, but I don't see her.
Join us. We can.
So this is $37 million in ongoing funding for court reporters in non-criminal assignments that are generally described as court reporters in family law and civil cases. So the allocation is very specific that this funding is intended to increase court reporters' in those assignments. The 37 million is broken up into two parts. The 30 million addresses the court reporters, and it's to again increase the court reporters, the number of court reporters in family and civil law cases, and notably without supplanting existing. So that means, as an example, a court could not, and Zlatko is going to back me up on this, and so is Rebecca, and we've already had meetings on this, and this is admittedly a term that we want to follow precisely, but has challenges to it to make sure we do follow it precisely. And that is that a court could not move court reporters, and just as a general example, out of family or civil to another assignment, and then hire additional reporters to put into family and civil, because that is supplanting. So essentially speaking, as an analogy, all the pieces on the chessboard have to remain as they are. And then the court can go out and use this money to hire additional court reporters in non-criminal assignments, civil and criminal. That's the $30 million.
I'm taking it, this is David, I'm taking it that this is figurative. In other words, in courts like San Diego, reporters aren't really assigned to a department. They're just, we have X number that we need, or do I have to start? In other words, if we're all in one building, or we're on basically, the majority of us are in two buildings that are connected. So if you need a reporter,
well, it doesn't, you're right, Judge Rubin. Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt. It doesn't, reporters for court purposes can be assigned throughout the courthouse during the course of a day. But right. And this is where Rebecca, I think, will perhaps help us clarify this. From a CEO position, however, they're dedicated spots. Rebecca,
oh, no, yes, exactly. That's what I mean. Right. Like, I'm not talking about if reporter X does family, reporter X can never help out in civil. It's just that you have 10 people assigned to family. You have to add to that. You can't rearrange them,
right,
redistribute them, and not add.
Right. So you're going to be, what we're going to be looking for is some kind of a reporting mechanism from, in particularly with the large courts. What are you scheduling now into those case law types? So if you're scheduling 10 reporters in, you should have a net new of one or two or more, where you have now 12 or something to that effect, not supplanting where you move two out and then you bring two more in and you still have 10. And so it does not necessarily mean that Joe Smith is your reporter that is always in that family law reporting, and nobody else can ever go in to back him up or anything else.
All right, perfect.
Thanks for clarifying that, Judge Rubin and Rebecca. The other portion of the $37 million is $7 million to establish a methodology to allocate to the courts to cover the costs associated with increased transcript rates. So while it appears to be a little more black and white, it has equal facets to it regarding the courts, how individual courts have transcript rates, different terms that come into play. And Rebecca, the term is escaping me that we really discussed last night.
Multipliers,
thank you. Which up until apparently a year ago were really unknown to quite a few people. But the way the transcript rates are determined is turning out to be in and of itself a challenge. I should note on the side that we've received great assistance from this, from Corey and his staff, from Rob and his staff, from Zlatko, from Budget Services. Everybody's coming together on this, and we will accomplish the task. But the language is so specific that we are treading as carefully as we can to make sure that we do. Our first meeting, we've formed a working group. Kevin's on the working group. I think Kevin as well, Rebecca and myself and a few others. Our first meeting was last night. Our next meeting will be next week. And we hope to get it back to JBBC in a timely manner. But we've learned in the past that if we rush through developing an allocation methodology in the interest of time over quality, we pay a price. So we're not going to do that. But we are going to be as efficient as we can when we get it to you. The ad hoc subcommittee continues its work, and we'll update you as we go.
I have a question for Budget Services, and maybe Corey's not here, but so I know some of the I understand that some of the CEOs have been trying to explain to legislators, et cetera, that their court reporter issue is, of course, funding is always a component, but that it's largely a supply problem versus a funding problem. My question is, therefore, if we cannot hire enough court reporters to spend the money, is there something built into the legislation that allows us to keep going with it, or has it got a sunset in terms of when we have to spend it by?
Blackham? You're muted.
It's ongoing funding. I'm actually having a discussion with the Department of Finance to ask about any unspent funds. We want to be fully transparent and accountable with the dollars, and so making sure that we're getting the right feedback from the administration is important. And if we need to engage with discussions with legislature, we will. As Judge Conklin and Rebecca have talked about, it's critical that we are very transparent with what we're doing with this money.
Agreed. That was like sort of asking. All right. Any questions for Budget Services, John or Rebecca, on the reporters? All right, well, good luck finding one, everybody. So, interesting factoid, in San Diego, the court employs 25% of the available court reporters in the county, which means we are the market, and we're just struggling so hard to hire, and we are desperately short. It's just a very interesting situation. All right, Judge Conklin.
John's the kindest thing anybody ever says to me all day, so I'll take it anytime I can. This is item number three. This is an action item. I'm here with Rebecca just to present it, but it's going to be Audrey and Kelly are going to give us the meat and potatoes of this stuff. This addresses federally funded dependency representation program and the funding allocation methodology for general fund supplement to address the shortfall. And so I've now presented it. Rebecca, did you want to add anything before they actually give us how it works?
No, I'm good.
Okay, and I apologize in advance. You're going to see me click off in just a couple of minutes because I have to get back to my jury trial. And if I do that, I'll turn it over to Judge Rubin or Rebecca to ask for the recommendation that's set forth. It's actually set forth on page 10 of your materials. Recommendations 1 through 4 be approved. That's the ultimate goal, approve 1 through 4. But to get there, I'm going to turn it over. Thank you all.
And also, John, I don't see, it was a great report. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm Audrey Fancy with CFCC, and I'm here with my colleague Kelly Bieleb, who's going to first present some background information on the federally funded dependency representation program before I present you with TICFAC's recommendations.
Thank you, Audrey. As Audrey mentioned, we wanted to start first with some background information about the federally funded dependency representation program, hereafter referred to as FFDRP. This program was implemented in fiscal year 2019-20 following a 2019 change to the Child Welfare Policy Manual, which was updated by the Administration for Children and Families to add and make clear that legal representation for children and parents in an eligible is an eligible Title IV-E administrative cost. Traditionally, Title IV-E foster care funds were limited to child welfare workers and agency counsel. California was an early adopter of this program before the Children's Bureau issued program guidance. And during implementation, we received new guidance and clarification that required providers to make adjustments that were challenging and very time consuming. Before the program was implemented, the Court Executives Advisory Committee formed an ad hoc working group to assist with program development. Then, late in fiscal year 2019-20, the Judicial Council entered into a contract with the California Department of Social Services, who is California's Title IV-E pass-through agency, and then we contracted with providers across the state. In order to participate in the program, providers must first complete an application that puts forth a plan to implement attributes from an established list for purposes of improving the quality of legal representation, as well as a proposed budget for use of the funding. These applications must be reviewed and approved by program staff as well as the court before we issue provider contracts. To establish our FFDRP funding allocations, we first determine the available funding for each court based on their proportional share of court-appointed counsel funding. We then establish individual provider allocations based on their proportional share of the court's court-appointed counsel funding. The FFDRP reimbursement amounts are subject to the California 4E eligibility rate, which for fiscal year 21-22 is 54%, though this rate does potentially change from year to year. The reimbursement amounts are also subject to the federal 4E administrative reimbursement rate of 50%. To give you an example of a potential shortfall, if a provider has an FFDRP contract for up to $10,000 and they are able to bill at 70%, they would receive a reimbursement of 7%, leaving a gap in funding of $3,000. We do have some program information and statistics to share with you from fiscal years 2019-20 and 2020-21. In fiscal year 1920, our first year of implementation, we paid out $26 million in FFDRP reimbursements. At that time, we had a total of 61 providers from 21 courts across the state. That $26 million in reimbursements fell short of our best case estimate for a number of reasons, which I'll go over in just a moment, but does represent 62% of the FFDRP contracts. The total reimbursement amounts were affected by multiple factors, one being that not all activities that are funded by court-appointed counsel funding are eligible for federal match. For example, activities around individualized education plans, individualized family service plans, special immigrant juvenile status, restraining orders, collaborative court, and other non-case specific activities. Other factors that impacted payouts were that some providers were unable to implement and match the enhancements approved in their FFDRP applications since we implemented the program late in the fiscal year. Compiling the detailed documentation to properly claim for federal reimbursement also presented challenges for our providers. As I mentioned earlier, not all activities are eligible for federal reimbursement, and some providers received federal loans and grants, such as PPP loans, which are ineligible for federal reimbursement. In fiscal year 2021, the Administration for Children and Families examined our FFDRP program guidance on eligible activities and expenses. During this time, FFDRP staff instructed providers to track uncertain items separately, and most providers opted not to bill until we received clarity regarding eligible activities and expenses. We did receive guidance and clarification in late spring, and we are now reviewing and processing invoices for fiscal year 2021.
Cognizant of billing challenges and with a desire to fully fund the Council's court-appointed counsel caseload goal of 141 clients, the legislature set aside $30 million annually to fill this gap. The Council is required to submit a report by April 2022 detailing three things. First, the total federal reimbursement invoiced statewide in the first two quarters of the current fiscal year. Second, any projected shortfall through the end of the current fiscal year as compared to the $57 million in expected federal reimbursement. And finally, a proposed allocation and distribution of any portion of the $30 million necessary to address projected shortfalls. The Budget Act further directs us to work in collaboration with court-appointed dependency counsel providers on timely invoicing to ensure that we have an accurate assessment of what the amount of federal funding can be achieved. In order to submit a legislative report by April, we have proposed the following timeline. First, development of this methodology in the fall so that we can submit a report to the January Council meeting with the recommended methodology. We would then be able to prepare a legislative report for the March Council meeting to meet the April 1st, 2022 deadline, at which point we would have funding to provide providers and any unused funds would revert to the State General Fund on October 1st, 2022. In our conversations with the Department of Finance and referring to language in the Budget Act, it is clear that the Council is to propose a system for allocating and distributing the additional dollars that will, quote, address any shortfalls in federal reimbursements. Therefore, only those providers who have entered into an FFDRP contract are eligible for this augmentation funding. Council staff are currently asking non-participating courts about interest in having their providers join FFDRP. This methodology would ask that by December 31st, providers either join the program, provide a notice of intent to access these additional funds for any given fiscal year. To further meet the requirement of participation, TICFAC proposes requiring monthly invoicing absent documentation of extraordinary circumstances. TICFAC recommends a two-phased approach for the payment schedule. First, for this fiscal year, given the requirements of the April 2022 legislative report, a lump sum payment is the only workable time frame. However, on an ongoing basis, a quarterly payment structure is recommended to balance the needs for provider cash flow and program fidelity. Given the invoice projection Kelly mentioned, it is highly unlikely we will exceed the $30 million budget at this time. Assuming the gap is less than $30 million, TICFAC proposes funding all providers with FFDRP contracts for the full amount of the shortfall between their FFDRP contract and the total billing. However, were the gap to exceed $30 million, TICFAC proposes a proportional distribution plan mirroring the underlying court-appointed allocation process, where initially all providers would receive a proportional increase matching the shortfall. And if any providers exceed their contract cap, those excess funds would be made available to other providers. The value of this approach is that it would incentivize active invoicing while providing much needed relief to all providers. As noted earlier, the budget bill requires provider engagement in this process. To meet this requirement, staff has met three times with our FFDRP communication team comprised of a cross-section of providers, as well as convening all FFDRP participants to gather their feedback. The providers are supportive of the four recommendations and committed to active billing to capture as much federal funding as possible. I've turned this over, I believe, now to Ms. Fleming, since we've lost Judge Conklin, but Kelly and I would also be very happy to answer any questions you have about the program, this new funding, or the proposed methodology.
Thank you, Audrey. I would just like to add that the staff handling this issue have been tremendous. This work and the data that they have gathered is really impressive. They've done a really great job at breaking down this issue. And so with that, I would actually turn it back over to Judge Rubin.
Thank you very much, Ms. Fleming. Yeah, the report was great. The presentation's been really good and clear. Let me ask members any questions for, I guess now it's Ms. Fleming or Ms. Fancy, and we had another presenter whose name escapes me this instant, but any questions of them? Go ahead and, because the presentation's up, I cannot see you, so just go ahead and jump in.
So this is Judge Mormon. I don't have any questions. I thought the report and the materials was very, very well written, very informative. I had to read it two or three times to capture, I think, all the important elements. But nevertheless, it was very, very helpful to have in advance of the meeting today. Thank you.
Yeah, there is Ms. Mielib. Thank you for being back.
David, this is Judge Bakke. I agree. I think what Judge Mormon said is correct. The report was great. And I want to thank Audrey specifically, who I worked with many years ago on FAM-JUVE, and it's good to see her, and I'm glad that this is coming out. This was really well done. Thank you.
Can I get a motion maybe on the four recommendations?
Move to approve. This is Judge Bakke.
Second. Hop.
All right, Hop seconds. All right, that doesn't mean we can't continue chatting and complimenting the staff on such a great effort. Any more comments or thoughts? Anything from Budget Services?
Not on my end.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Well, hearing no more discussion, there's a motion, a second. All those in. Actually, so I can see everybody. Can the recommendations come down so I can see the. There we go. For purposes of voting. All right. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Abstain? All right, it passes unanimously. Great job to the staff and great job to Judge Conklin and Ms. Fleming for bringing this also to us. This relief in the making, and so thank you. All right.
Thank you. And Judge Rubin, I will be excusing myself. I believe that's the end of our items.
Right. Well, I think that's actually, unless I'm missing something, the end of our business as well. Does anybody have, well, okay, first of all, any staff can go. I mean, that presented, great, if you don't want to stay. Does anybody have anything for the good of the order?
Yeah, Judge Rubin, we've got a meeting on the 18th, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, great, thanks.
Right, right, an educational meeting should be very interesting. We have some good information, good things lined up. Anything else? All right, hearing none. First of all, thank you all for being here. So we'll see each other on the 18th, and then we're not gonna see each other till the new year. So for some reason, a staff member or a member of the committee, what, somebody should say something?
Yeah, it's Angela. We are actually looking to schedule, and we have scheduled a meeting December 7th. December 7th.
Right. All right. So we're working hard. But if I miss anybody in the meeting, just have a great holiday season. Otherwise, I'll see all of you at all three meetings. This is becoming a very intensive process for all of you. But thank you.
I hope we get together in person soon, Mr. Chair.
So we should talk about that. Like, let me talk with staff about that, because I think, let me talk to John and Zlatko and Millicent about that, because I think we might be a great committee to start with. We're not huge. A lot of the staff is already in Sacramento. You know, we might be perfect.
Judge Rubin, this is John Wardlaw, and the Judicial Council staff are planning a hybrid work model effective January 10th, in which we will have more and more folks on site, and they'll happy to have a conversation with you, Judge, about kind of plans for the committee. We will make sure that we support you in whatever capacity, whether it's remote or in person.
Thank you. Then Judge Mormon and I will caucus, and I'll caucus with you, and then we'll see if we can't be part of that hybrid part where we're actually on site. Great. Anything else for the good of the order? That was a good one. All right. Hearing none, then thank you all. Have a great day. Do some justice out there. Talk to you.